The Guardian.
Switching to the redundant sense sequencer. T-minus 27 seconds. We have gone for redundant set sequencer start. T-minus 20 seconds and counting.
First venture into space. Two American astronauts are poised and waiting to add a new dimension to space travel.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. We've gone for main engine start. We have main engine start. America's first space shuttle. And the shuttle has cleared the tower.
Welcome to Science Weekly Extra from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Alok Jha.
Fly like an eagle.
On the 12th of April 1981, Columbia was the first shuttle to go into space.
434, Max Cube RE.
Roger.
2011 marks the 30th anniversary of that milestone. It's also the year the space shuttles will be retired from service.
Houston, you're go at throttle up.
Former NASA astronaut Dr. Jeff Hoffman has been speaking about his involvement with the program and what's next for human spaceflight.
Roger on the SIP, Columbia.
Mark 2:20, confirm
solid rocket booster set. I'm Jeff Hoffman. Formerly, I was a U.S. astronaut working at NASA for 25 years. I made five space flights on the space shuttle, and I'm now a professor of aerospace engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Just tell us, first of all, what it was like the first time you went into space.
It's an unforgettable experience. Actually, you get selected as an astronaut, and there's a period of quite a few years where you have to go through basic training and learn a lot about space technology in general and the shuttle in particular with all its systems. And so it's a long process. And after you've been there for a few years, you start wondering, you know, when am I going to get assigned to a flight? Because, of course, that's what we all go there for. And so the first part of the excitement is when you first get called up into the office of the head of the flight crew operations and says, Jeff, got good news. We've got a flight for you. And, of course, at that point, I'm floating off the earth anyway, just with the excitement that, you know, after years of waiting, I've got a flight assignment. We actually had to wait quite a bit. I was first assigned to fly in June of 1984, but because of various difficulties with the shuttle and payloads and flights got canceled and crews got switched around, so we didn't end up flying until April of 1985. In fact, we launched on April the 12th, which was the same day that the first shuttle flight had flown 4 years earlier. And of course, April 12th is the date of Yuri Gagarin's first manned space flight back in 1961. So it was a good day to launch when all was said and done. People had told me a lot about what it was like, you know, what to look for, what it's going to feel like. But I just have to tell you that there's no way that words convey the enormous power of a rocket lifting off the ground, whether it's a space shuttle or a Soyuz or a Saturn or you know, everybody who's ridden rockets just has this overwhelming sense of the power that we've harnessed in this machine in order to break the bounds of gravity and get into orbit. The actual process of the countdown, of course, the tension builds, and you know, when you're sitting out there in the rocket all alone and you realize that the amount of energy underneath you is equivalent to a small atomic bomb, you just hope that everybody's done their job right and that the vehicle is really ready to go, which in my case, on all of my five flights, the shuttle worked just fine.
Now, despite all your training and your desire to get into space, there must have been a large part of you that was pretty terrified when you're sat on the launch pad. I mean, I hate flying. I can't imagine what it must be like knowing that you're sitting on top of like you say, something that is like a bomb?
Well, you know, fear is very subjective. My personality is such that when I'm faced with something that I have absolutely no control over, it tends not to bother me. I just have the ability to put any potential fear off in another mental compartment somehow. And I, you know, maybe psychologists can identify the phenomenon or even have a word for it. But, you know, I've done other potentially dangerous things like parachuting and rock climbing and ski racing. There's many things that can go wrong. I work hard to prepare myself so that anything that I do have control over, and I think this goes for everybody else on the crew, you know, we spend a lot of time practicing. What do we do if? And I had good confidence that if there was anything within our ability to control, that we would be able to do what had to be done. And if something happens that I can't do anything about, then what's the point worrying? And of course, that's a very rational way of looking at it, and fear is not rational. You will find astronauts who will tell you that they don't like launches. They get nervous. They worry about the consequences. Luckily, my personality protected me from that, and I always took the idea that, you know, hey, not very many people get a chance to do this, so I'm going to sit back and enjoy the ride. And boy, it is quite a ride.
Now, Jeff, you were the first astronaut to log more than 1,000 hours of flight time aboard the shuttle. What things do you take away from those moments when you realize you're in space? You know, those moments back on Earth when you're dealing with menial things, you know, you realize you've been up there.
Well, no peak experience, and certainly flying in space is a peak experience. It can't last forever. I've climbed mountains where, you know, you stand on the summit and you know, you feel like you're on top of the world, and in the sense you are, and it's a wonderful feeling. There's a sense of accomplishment, and the same thing with a space flight. Of course, for a space flight, you're going a lot higher. There's probably a lot more danger than in some other activities, but nevertheless, you have to have the realization that it's not going to last forever. So like mountain climbing, you know, you can't stay on the summit. You do have to come down. And it's the recollection of the things that you saw and did when you were up at those heights that continues to influence your life. I can't say that being in space has fundamentally changed my personality. And on the other hand, I can sort of close my eyes and look back on our Earth as a planet, which is an experience that very few people have been privileged enough to see. The thing that's in my memory is not just the personal experiences that I had, the new perspective on our planet, the extraordinary pleasure of having your body lose all its weight and just being able to float, you know, fly like a bird, so to speak, but without having even to exert the energy of flapping wings. But it's also the things that we accomplished. I mean, we did a lot of very significant things, whether scientific experiments or engineering tests that we carried out, or the initial rescue and repair of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is probably the thing that I feel most proud about and that probably had the most significance for other people in the world at large of any of the things that I've done in space. So, you know, I can look back and in addition to the personal recollections of the wondrous experience and the physical sensation, I also have the memory of all of the significant things that we accomplished, and I'm quite proud of that, and that's something that will stay with me all my life.
Now, Jeff, you performed 4 spacewalks, including the first unplanned contingency spacewalk in NASA's history. Just tell us what happened there.
Well, on every shuttle flight, even ones where a spacewalk is not being planned, we train 2 people how to use a spacesuit, just in case something comes up where you need to go outside and fix something. In some cases, it might be a problem with the shuttle that otherwise might prevent you from coming home, and that's pretty important. So they take the training seriously, and I was one of the two people in our crew who received that training. So we knew how to use spacesuits. We had spent quite a bit of time underwater training. Originally, the purpose of our flight was basically just to take two telecommunications satellites and kick them out of the shuttle, and they have their own upper stage motors, which would take them into geostationary orbit. Once we get rid of those satellites, in general, the shuttle's responsibility is finished, because the satellites do their own thing. But one of the satellites that we tossed out of the shuttle was, we didn't know why at the time, but it didn't do anything. It just didn't activate. It just sat there. Obviously, the people on the ground were pretty concerned. They started to think about what failures could have caused that. And there was one critical switch on the outside of the satellite, which is held closed as long as the satellite is in the shuttle's cargo bay. It's a safety measure, because you don't want the ignition sequence of the satellite's upper stage motor to start when it's still in the shuttle, because, you know, that would be a bad day for everyone. So the postulate was that switch may have gotten stuck, and so the ground came up with a plan whereby we actually had to manufacture a special tool. It looked a little bit like a fly swatter, so this became known as the fly swatter mission, and we were the SWAT team. We made the tool out of a lot of things sort of lying around. It's a little bit like that scene in Apollo 13 where they dump everything on the table and said, you know, here's what the crew has on board. Figure out how to make this device. And we did it. And then the two of us actually had to go out and attach it to the end of the shuttle's robotic manipulator arm. It was not a super difficult spacewalk to do, but it was the first time that NASA had ever sent people out in spacesuits where this had never been planned before the mission. So it really was quite a milestone.
Endeavour has a firm handshake with Mr. Hubble's telescope.
We copy that, Covey, and there are smiles galore down here.
It showed an ability to take risks, and of course also a confidence in us that even though we hadn't been planning to do a spacewalk, we could go out and accomplish this, which we did. And so it was, of course, very exciting, because when we go through the training, a dream of actually getting to go outside. In fact, I even remember after our last training session in the big water tank where we practice spacewalking underwater, as they were pulling us out of the water, I thanked all of the people, because there's dozens of people who are involved in these training sessions. I said, you know, thanks, guys. And by the way, if we ever get to do a spacewalk, we'll throw a beer party for everyone. And they reminded us of that when we got back. And so, sure enough, we did throw a big beer bash. And it was worth every penny of paying for the beer to thank all the people who had gotten us ready so that we can actually go and do that.
And Houston, if you copy, Jeff's just working, putting the doors back together, and thinks he's found a way that seems to close the gap. And we're going to try that, if that's okay.
It turned out that when they were getting ready to assign a crew for the mission to rescue the Hubble Space Telescope, because it was such a critical mission for NASA, they decided that only people who had previously done spacewalks would be eligible to be assigned as spacewalkers for Hubble. And because of this completely unexpected spacewalk that I had done on my first flight, I had my EVA union card, so to speak. So I was lucky enough to get assigned to go and fix Hubble.
So, Jeff, on the 12th of April 1981, the world watched as Columbia blasted off for the very first time. That's back in the 80s. It's an old machine, and it's going to retire this year. I mean, what are your feelings?
30 years. And, you know, over 130 flights for the shuttle fleet. It didn't fly as often as people were originally hoping, but nevertheless, it's been an extraordinary machine. The versatility of the shuttle, the different roles that it's played, are just unprecedented in the history of spaceflight, and probably are not going to be duplicated in the foreseeable future. I mean, the shuttle is not only transportation into space, but once it's up in orbit, we've used it to launch satellites. We've used it with the space lab built by the European Space Agency as a scientific laboratory. We've used it for engineering tests. We've used it for repairing satellites in space, for bringing satellites back home to be repaired on the ground and relaunched. We used it to extend the life of the Russian Mir space station by several years. And of course, now it's just in its final phases being used for the construction and now the completion and supply of the International Space Station. So it's been a multi-purpose machine that has done things that were never possible to do in space without the capabilities of a large vehicle like the shuttle. We're going to miss it when it's gone.
It's an incredible machine, and in fact, I cry every time I see the shuttle launch for some reason. It was supposed to be a cheap way to get into space. Why did that not happen? Why was it so expensive?
Well, the original concept behind the shuttle was modeled after airplanes. The idea that if you had to build a new airplane every time you flew from New York to London, transatlantic flight would never have become a commercial endeavor and people wouldn't be doing it so much. And the idea was reusability. And the mantra was, if you can reuse it, it will be cheaper. The thing was, you know, when you think about it, the shuttle was the first reusable spacecraft, and people didn't know anything about building a reusable spacecraft. It was an extraordinary undertaking. You know, if this had been done in maybe a more rational way, we would have continued to fly the Apollo hardware, the Saturn rockets and the Apollo capsules, while we built a small reusable vehicle like one of the X-planes and actually learn what was involved in reusability. But no, we undertook this, the whole the shuttle, you know, this huge vehicle, and it's remarkable that it's worked as well as it had. I mean, obviously, it's not a perfect vehicle, and we've had a couple of disasters, but nevertheless, it's accomplished amazing things. But when you talk to the engineers who designed all the different systems, they knew how to build the systems, and that's why the shuttle works, but they didn't know how to make things reusable. So, you know, for various reasons, NASA, the Office of Management and Budget, Congress, they basically decreed that the shuttle should fly, you know, several dozen times a year, because that's what you had to do in order to make the economic calculations look reasonable. The thing is, when you're flying a shuttle, you have a huge workforce, and that's where the money is going. I mean, we don't send dollar bills up in space. We use them to pay the people who prepare and operate the shuttle for flight. And you're paying that standing army whether you fly once a year or 50 times a year. Sure, there's a little bit of extra cost for the fuel and the external tank, which gets burned up after every flight. But it was just never possible to fly the shuttle safely more than, I think, 9 times was the most we ever flew in a year. And nowadays, we fly just, you know, 3 or 4 times a year. And so the huge fixed cost has to be amortized over just a small number of flights. And so the cost per flight is not nearly as low as people had originally hoped. But we've learned an awful lot about reusable vehicles. So the next time around, I think we'll know a lot more. As well, of course, the shuttle was the first real winged vehicle that went into orbit. And every time it comes back through the atmosphere, it enters the atmosphere at 25 times the speed of sound. So we've built up an enormous database on hypersonic flight, which is going to be extremely useful for the next generation of winged vehicles.
4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Flight controllers here looking very carefully at the situation. Obviously a major malfunction.
Do you think the shuttle would be flying beyond 2011 if Challenger and Columbia had still been around?
We have a report from the flight dynamics officer that the vehicle has exploded.
Very good question. And, you know, NASA on numerous occasions throughout the history of the shuttle conducted studies on what should we do in the future. You know, should we build a new vehicle or should we put the money into refurbishing the shuttle and keeping it flying?
Columbia continuing toward Florida, now approaching the New Mexico-Texas border.
And Columbia, Houston, we see your tire pressure messages and we did not copy your last.
Roger.
And that was the last we heard, apart from a burst of static.
I think even as late as the Columbia accident, just before that, most people were assuming that the shuttle would be flying into the early 20s at least, you know, sort of a model of the B-52, which was brought into service in the late 50s, and they're still flying. The environment of space, though, is a lot more severe than what airplanes undergo, and I think it was certainly after Columbia, people just had to realize that, it's time. The shuttle, it's getting old. The maintenance requirements are getting more and more severe in order to be able to continue to fly safely. And we need to do something new. And that's, I think, when the final decision was made that the shuttle should be retired. And I think that's the right thing to do. As I say, we're going to miss the shuttle because all the capabilities that it's given us to operate in low Earth orbit. But from NASA's point of view, we're going to turn over the transport to low Earth orbit, to the space station and any other places in near the Earth that we want to go to. In the U.S., that's going to be given to private industry who will operate rockets on their own. The rockets won't belong to NASA. NASA will basically buy the launch services, and that will allow NASA to concentrate on building the next generation of rocket, which will be a heavy lift launch vehicle, which finally, several decades after the end of Apollo, will give us the ability once again to leave Earth's orbit and start exploring back to the moon, near-Earth asteroids, someday the moons of Mars, the surface of Mars. You know, there's a lot of things we'd like to do, with the money, hopefully, that NASA will save by not having to operate the shuttle and provide the whole infrastructure, it'll be able to put more resources into exploration, which is really what NASA should be doing, rather than running a taxi service between the surface of the Earth and the International Space Station. So that's what I hope we'll see in the future. The future still has to be created, and there's a lot of work between here and there, but that's the way things are shaping up.
Well, I guess this is the big question at the moment, isn't it? After Discovery and Atlantis and Endeavour all go up for the last time this year, what's next for NASA's human spaceflight program?
Well, human spaceflight, not just for NASA, but for most of the spacefaring world, with the exception of the Chinese, the human spaceflight is the International Space Station. And we will continue to operate the space station. I think there's big challenges ahead in turning the space station into a working scientific lab and being able to conduct useful and hopefully productive research up there. So that's going to be the focus near the Earth. And in the meantime, NASA is going to be working with industry on developing this large rocket, which when it's finally flying, once again, will give us the ability to explore beyond the Earth, which I think is what inspired so many people about Apollo. And I'd like to see that come back.
We will invest more than $3 billion to conduct research on an advanced heavy lift rocket. a vehicle to efficiently send into orbit the crew capsules, propulsion systems.
When Obama canceled the Constellation program, what were your feelings at that point?
Well, I had been enthusiastic about Constellation because I liked the idea of reusing some of the shuttle hardware and getting back to the moon as quickly as we could. But Constellation was never funded at the level that the Bush administration promised, and it was falling further and further behind schedule, and the projected costs were continually escalating.
Our second goal is to develop and test a new spacecraft. The Crew Exploration Vehicle. The Crew Exploration Vehicle will be capable of ferrying astronauts and scientists to the space station after the shuttle is retired.
A lot of us had come to be skeptical that Constellation was ever going to reach its goal. It could have if the money had been there. And so we needed to do something to change the paradigm because, you know, another big crash program like Apollo was just not going to happen. I mean, Apollo was a very unique time in history. It was the Cold War, and there was a very robust American economy, and it was all something new. And I don't think those elements are ever going to come together. So affordability has become much more critical in our space activities, and we really have a challenge now to build a rocket that we can operate affordably and conduct an exploration program on a much more limited budget than we had in Apollo. I think it can be done if there's the political will, and we'll just have to see how things evolve. I hope it will happen because I'd hate to think that, 100 years from now, people will look back and say, ah, yes, back in the 1960s and early 70s, we actually left the Earth and went to the moon. Wasn't that a wonderful thing to do? I wonder why we've never done it again. That would be tragic.
It almost feels wrong that space exploration, it's such a unique endeavor in human history that it comes down to money. It comes down to budgeting. It feels like it should be beyond that.
Well, in a sense, during Project Apollo, it was, because there were so many other motivating factors. But spaceflight is not cheap, and somebody's got to pay for it. The private sector is actually moving into human spaceflight, and perhaps by competition and more launches, they actually will succeed in bringing down the cost of getting into space, because really it's the first step that's the most difficult, just getting off Earth into orbit, even if you're only a few hundred miles above the Earth. From there, if NASA can then provide the vehicles to take us beyond, but with the savings of the private sector providing the initial launch, then maybe NASA will have the resources to be able to conduct a meaningful and exciting program of exploration. I hope that's true, because I'd like to see my grandchildren experience the same sense of wonder at humans walking on the surface of another heavenly body that I did and that so many of us did back in the late 60s and early 70s.
Jeff, an absolute honor to speak to a real-life astronaut. Thank you so much for your time today.
Always a pleasure. I enjoy reading The Guardian, and be very nice to listen to the podcast. So thanks very much.
Airspeed 271 knots.
Former NASA astronaut Jeff Hoffman, speaking to producer Andy.
Fido says it couldn't be any better.
Next week, we have a special program from Washington, D.C. at this year's AAAS. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
Welcome home, Columbia. Beautiful, beautiful. For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.